Asian Americans are queer. Queers are Asian Americans and immigrants. National LGBTAP organizations need to adopt issues and resolutions in support of immigrants' rights. We also need to contemplate organizing in languages other than English.
If it were all a matter of strategies about how to keep from doing drugs or alcohol, it would be very boring. But what's so exciting is that you see people fundamentally changing. There's nothing more interesting or exciting to me than that.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Filipino comrades-in-arms join hands in matrimony. A groundbreaking report surveys U.S. Asian queers, and lesbo-gay recovery is about vastly more than that. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 12, 2005. The Communist Party of the Philippines this week celebrated its first gay wedding between members of its New People's Army. The government of the heavily Catholic Philippines has so far rejected all legal recognition for same-gender couples, but the rebel CPP added marriage equality to its guiding policy in 1998. Comrades Andres and Jose were joined in a military ceremony identical to those held for heterosexual couples. Each held a bullet representing their commitment in the armed struggle as they exchanged vows while wrapped in a large CPP flag along with their party sponsors. Other party members sang revolutionary songs and made a bridge of rifles for them. One spokesperson for the Philippines mainstream army called the widely publicized wedding propaganda meant to recruit gays into the rebel army, while two others said it showed the communists have no religion and no God. But the national lesbi-gay group Pro-Gay praised the CPP for advancing their civil rights and called on the national government to enact equality legislation instead of denouncing same-gender marriages.
The U.S. Department of Defense this week reported fewer discharges of gay and lesbian service members in 2004 than any time since it began tracking what it calls homosexual discharges in 1997. After reaching an all-time high of more than 1,227 in 2001, the first year of the Bush administration, those figures have dropped each year since to reach 653 in 2004. That's a 47% drop for the period, while 2004 figures were 15% lower than 2003. The discharges have decreased in all branches of the military. While the Pentagon refused to comment on the figures, there's little doubt the decrease represents the military's need for personnel and so-called stop-loss policies in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq following the 9/11 terrorist attacks of 2001. Each time there's been an armed conflict since the U.S. formally banned gays and lesbians from military service in World War II, those discharges have decreased, only to shoot up dramatically when the conflict ends. The ban's modification to the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy of the last decade has not changed that pattern. Those who seek equal treatment for military gays and lesbians claim this pattern underscores the hypocrisy of the policy. It's doubtful that the diminished discharges reflect an improved environment for gays and lesbians serving in the U.S. military. A record number of them contacted the Service Members Legal Defense Network in 2004, seeking help against harassment and discrimination.
Activist Scott McCoy this week became the first open gay or lesbian ever to be sworn into the state senate of conservative Utah. Democrats from a Salt Lake City district selected him to replace their senator who had to retire midterm for medical reasons, and Governor John Huntsman followed their lead to appoint him. McCoy is an attorney currently serving as vice chair of the lesbi-gay civil rights group Equality Utah. He gained recognition as the leader of the Don't Amend Alliance, which unsuccessfully campaigned against Utah's constitutional amendment prohibiting same-gender marriages.
The Washington State House this week approved openly gay Democratic Representative Ed Murray's bill to prohibit sexual orientation discrimination in employment, housing, and insurance. Over the last three decades, the Washington House has passed several similar civil rights measures, only to see them killed in the more conservative state Senate. But this year, the Democrats have control of the Washington Senate, so Murray and other activists are hopeful that what will still be a struggle there will end with Washington becoming the 15th U.S. state to protect lesbian-gay civil rights.
But more U.S. state legislatures are working on amending their state constitution to ban same-gender marriages. Virginia's House of Delegates this week gave more than 80% approval to a proposed amendment, and its Senate gave 75% approval to a very similar one. Should they reconcile the small differences this year, the proposed amendment would require approval by both houses again next year before going to a statewide ballot at the end of 2006. Despite the lopsided votes, the proposals faced vocal opposition, with one senator comparing the bill to Nazism, and the state's first openly gay lawmaker, Democratic delegate Adam Eben, warning his colleagues that they would one day look back on the vote with shame.
Alabama legislators made anti-marriage amendments their first votes on a statewide measure this session. This week, the Alabama Senate gave unanimous approval to one proposal, while the House approved a similar one by more than 90%, despite several hours of opposition filibustering. Once the two houses reconcile the differences, the measure will go to the voters, but one difference between the proposals is whether it should go on the 2006 November general election ballot or a primary election or special election ballot earlier that year. Both Virginia and Alabama already have laws in place against same-gender marriage.
Meanwhile, last week's remarkable New York State trial court decision requiring New York City to issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples is being appealed by the city. New York City attorneys are trying to get the appeal fast-tracked directly to the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals.
The U.S. religious right is taking its opposition to same-gender marriage across the border to Canada. Members of the Canadian Parliament are being actively lobbied by U.S. citizens to oppose their government's bill for marriage equality. The U.S. chapter of the Catholic men's group Knights of Columbus sent a five-figure contribution to support a church-based Canadian postcard campaign against marriage. The Colorado-based Christian media empire Focus on the Family has been pumping major funds and services into its affiliate, Focus on the Family Canada, for print ads and action kits, while its leader James Dobson has used his airtime to denounce Canadian marriage. MPs say they won't be influenced by U.S. lobbying, while Canadians of all stripes seem to generally resent the interference.
A bill to create legal registered partnerships for same-gender couples in the Czech Republic fell one vote shy of passage in the House of Deputies this week. It was the fourth time such a bill was defeated there. But activists had been particularly hopeful this time because there was support within almost all of the parliamentary political parties. In an attempt to deter opposition, one clause of the bill would have specifically excluded registered partners from adopting children.
Peru's highest court this week ordered the reinstatement of a police officer who'd been fired for marrying a transsexual. The National Police maintained that Jose Antonio Alvarez had been disobedient in failing to seek his superior's permission before the marriage. But the Constitutional Tribunal cited Peru's constitutional guarantee of equal treatment regardless of sexual orientation in ordering that he be rehired. According to the Associated Press, Alvarez's wife was outed as a transsexual by his pregnant girlfriend 6 years ago, and since then the controversial marriage was annulled and he married that girlfriend.
In Sweden, an appellate court this week reversed the hate speech conviction of a Pentecostal minister for a sermon he gave. The high-profile case last year saw Minister Åke Green sentenced to a month in jail for inciting hatred against gays and lesbians, the first time any clergy member had been convicted under that law. At issue was his 2003 sermon, including a statement that sexual abnormalities are like a cancer growth on society's body. But the appeals court found Green intended only to explain his understanding of the Bible, and so he was within his rights. The prosecutor hopes to further appeal the case to Sweden's Supreme Court.
And finally, by now you've heard plenty of stories of homosexual animals, and you might even know that Germany's Bremerhaven Zoo has three devoted long-term gay couples among its penguins. But zookeepers have a vested interest in their animals' reproduction, and even more so since these Humboldt penguins from South America are members of an endangered species. Some researchers believe captive penguins are more likely to form same-sex pairs due to lack of access to the opposite sex. That it's what in humans has sometimes been called situational homosexuality. So the Bremerhaven Zoo brought in four female penguins from Sweden to tempt their gay males. What the zoo wasn't prepared for was the massive calls and emails it then received from angry gays and lesbians. Of course, it didn't help that the zoo director described the procedure as a form of aversion therapy. Actually, the only pain inflicted on the gay penguins in the experiment, which was closely monitored by outsiders, was the pain of separation from their chosen partners as they were isolated with the Swedish females. Apparently, the gay male birds simply pined until reunited with their male mates. Saying their bond was too strong, the zoo has admitted defeat and abandoned the experiment for now, although there may be another attempt in the future. And the zoo is also looking out for those lonely Swedish females. Two more males have been brought in, ones they hope are single and heterosexual.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 12, 2005, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
The 12 steps may be the same, but gays and lesbians face unique obstacles in dealing with substance abuse. You'll hear from an expert later in the program. It probably comes as no surprise that Asian and Pacific Rim gays and lesbians in the U.S. face the dual discrimination of racism and homophobia. But being able to prove the obvious statistically can make all the difference in organizing for change. The National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute has taken an initial step in that direction with the first phase of its study, Asian Pacific American Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender People, a Community Portrait. Released in honor of the Lunar New Year, Phase 1 is a report from New York's Queer Asian Pacific Legacy Conference 2004. 124 conference attendees participated in the study, which selected a cross-section of men, women, and trans people who identified themselves as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and queer. Policy Institute Research Director Jason Chianciotto, study authors Elaine Dang and Mandy Hugh, and Glenn D. Magpante of Gay Asian and Pacific Islander Men of New York met the press via a conference call on February 8th to present their findings. Study co-author Elaine Dang.
The first major point that I wanted to make was overwhelmingly about 96% agreed that homophobia and transphobia is a problem in the Asian American community, with 54% strongly agreeing with that statement. About 80% agreed that Asian Pacific American lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people experience racism in the white LGBT community. The second major point that I wanted to make was that a majority felt that gay organizations inadequately address issues of race, class, and disability, and at the same time, mainstream Asian American organizations address gay issues even less adequately than gay organizations address race issues. Now I want to turn it over to Mandy Hu to speak about the other major findings.
I'm just going to follow up on what Alan has been pointing out with two more major findings. The first is that almost every single respondent, or about 95%, said that they'd experienced at least one form of discrimination in their lives. And then we asked our respondents to tell us a little bit more about the kinds of discrimination they experienced, and 4 out of 5, or 82%, said that they had been discriminated against because of their sexual orientation. The same percent, revealingly, that had said they'd been discriminated against because of their race or ethnicity. The second major point was that we asked our respondents to tell us what they thought were the most important issues facing gay Asians. And they said that immigration was the most important, followed by hate, violence, and harassment, and media representation. And this mirrors what our respondents said was important to all Asian Pacific Americans, regardless of sexual orientation, with immigration being by far the most cited issue. Now, let me turn you guys over to Glenn Magpontai from Gay Asian Pacific Islander Men of New York, who's going to give us a little context about gay Asians in America.
Gonghae Fa Choi. It's the year of the rooster, and we'll be celebrating the Lunar New Year. given me very proud to be working with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute to try to bring the issues of concerns of LGBT Asian Americans to the fore. The findings that Alan and Mandy had talked about regarding discrimination, media representation, hate violence, and immigrants' rights are some of the most important issues facing the lesbian, gay, and bisexual transgender APA community today. Asian Americans are among the fastest growing minority groups, and yet, and more and more LGBT APAs are coming out, yet the community still faces discrimination, violence, isolation, and invisibility. We have a lot of work to do before us. The task force has presented a tremendous study with tremendous findings, and we look forward to the collaboration and the work that's ahead of us. Thank you.
This is Jason Sanciato. Before we begin the question and answer period, I did want to point out that you can download a version of this study for free from our website. If you go to our homepage at www.thetaskforce.org, the task force is all one word, you can actually click on a link to a downloadable PDF right on the homepage. It's the first link under the features section on the right-hand column of the page. And now we're ready for questions.
Everybody says there's a lot of work to do. I'm wondering whether any of you have any specifics that you can elaborate on in terms of what kinds of work need to be and can be done.
This is Glenn from Gepimni, and part of the work that needs to be done is, from what we see, Asian Americans are queer. Queers are Asian Americans and immigrants. National LGBT AP organizations need to adopt issues and resolutions in support of immigrants' rights. We also need to contemplate organizing in languages other than English. So many Asian Americans speak a language other than English in their homes. Likewise, in the Asian American community, we need to and have already also supported the rights of LGBT APAs, particularly in same-sex marriage, in our campaigns to be free from discrimination, whether it be in schools. And so I think the organizations need to be more responsive to all of our communities, and we need to develop more coalition building between our groups.
Thank you.
And it appears we have no further questions from our phone audience. I would like to turn the conference back over to the speakers for any additional or closing comments.
This is Jason Sanciato again. I'd like to thank all of the attendees on the call and encourage you to contact us if you have any further questions. Again, remind you that you can download a PDF of the study. We also have information for local contacts if you'd like to speak with someone in your local community about this study. And I think that's about it. Thank you very much.
That telephone press conference by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute featured Jason Cianciotto, Elaine Dang, Mandy Hugh, and Glenn D. Magpante discussing their new report, Asian Pacific American Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgendered People, A Community Portrait. The researchers plan to continue their study with surveys of Asian queers in several U.S. cities, including San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm B.D. Wong. I'm the actor from Law & Order Special Victims Unit and Oz, and the author of Following Fu, the Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. Oh yeah, I'm a gay guy.
Living with the homophobia in society and the homophobia inside is one of the significant factors leading to a higher incidence of alcohol and drug addiction among gay men and lesbians. The author of Vastly More Than That, Stories of Lesbians and Gay Men in Recovery, Guy Kettlehack, knows firsthand the challenges, triumphs, and setbacks they face. Vancouver, British Columbia-based This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching asked Kettlehack to step out of his expert role to talk about how he himself overcame crippling self-hatred.
I've been in recovery for quite a while. I sort of grew up in kind of a South Shore Long Island town, Amityville, the Amityville Horror, if you can remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Was pretty much a garden variety alcoholic as I went on. I began being able to drink everybody else under the table, which many incipient alcoholics think means that they're not alcoholic, but actually it's often very common. It was a way to escape myself. It was a way to escape fears of being gay. And when I finally, I went to college in Vermont at Middlebury, and then I went to New York when I was about 25, and I really just sort of spiraled very quickly down into kind of sex club stuff and bars and alcohol and drugs, and just kind of, you know, had a pretty common experience, unfortunately, for a lot of lesbians and gay men that I've since come to know. And I just really hit a kind of moment of such utter black despair that I, you know, I really didn't feel I could go on any longer. And the circumstances were, I don't know, I got home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I lived in this apartment building that was across from a park, and I came onto some teenage kid who turned on me with a knife and somehow just missed knifing me, basically, and I was drunk and moneyless, and I had this kind of revelation at that moment where he ran into the park. I was lucky I wasn't killed, that none of this would have happened if I hadn't been drunk. And I sort of climbed up to my apartment and passed out and woke up the next morning and kind of got the second half of the revelation, which was I really didn't want to drink anymore.
Hmm.
Really didn't want to drink anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that magic X factor moment is, you know, and I, as much as I've written about it and thought about it, not really able, you know, the only kind of thing I know how to do in books is what I think you do in recovery, which is you tell your story, you know, you tell people's stories. I don't have any self-help tips about it. I just know that when you hit anything like that despair, there's something to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my synonym for sobriety is consciousness, and or is conscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's a better deal being mm-hmm. conscious, I think.
Yeah. Are you essentially going through a process of almost, you know,
well,
starting from scratch, getting to know who you are as a human being?
I think so. I didn't really know who I was. I mean, you know, I've been through, you know, quite a few years since that moment, and the first book that I wrote was Easing the Ache, which was a book about gay men and in recovery. And the first version of that book was based on a diary I kept from the moment I stopped drinking. And I had worked in publishing. I was a literary agent. But, you know, my diary entries was, wow, oatmeal is really good. You know, it was like incredibly boring to anybody who had a life, you know. And yet I kept these, like, you know, these tiny little things. I'd spent all my time in bars after work. So I went home and I watched these reruns of sitcoms, and I mashed potatoes, and I had this kind of, like, you know, and went to a lot of meetings, but very kind of normal life for the first time in years. You know, I was actually, like, getting up at a normal time. I wasn't throwing up. I didn't feel, you know, like a, you know, puddle of you-know-what, you know. But that's, I guess, by way of saying that I really was bewildered. I mean, I was shell-shocked, and yet for me, I was lucky. I loved it. I was so ready for it, you know. It was just like I could see colors in the world again, you know. I slept for the first time, you know, rather than passing out.
Mm-hmm.
Sex was a different ball of wax. That I had to relearn, like over time. And that's I think that's a tough one, especially for us, because it's so linked, and especially now to drugs like crystal meth, and which is like rampant in this country. I mean, I don't know what it's like in Vancouver, but it's, you know, huge in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York. It's really endemic, and it's such a sexual drug for gay men.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a whole new ball game of recovery, really.
Mm-hmm. So what, I mean, you said that the experience for you is obviously really enjoyable and exhilarating.
Mostly, you know.
Yeah. You know, clearly it isn't that way for everybody.
I do think there are certain rites of passage many people seem to go through. In fact, I also have a series out from Hazelden called First Year Sobriety, Second Year Sobriety, and Third Year Sobriety, which attempts to look at, you know, what it's like during that shell shock state and kind of how you sort of piece together a self, really, over time. You know, the other thing about recovery, and it's probably why I've written about it or why I've been interested in it, the interesting part is not the alcohol or drugs. The interesting part is that you catch people in the act of becoming human, of becoming more human. You know, that's what's interesting. You know, if it were all a matter of, I don't know, strategies about how to keep, you know, from doing drugs or alcohol, it would be very boring. But what's so exciting is that you see people, you know, fundamentally changing, you know, and there's nothing more interesting or exciting to me than that.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know any recovering addict or alcoholic or active addict and alcoholic who doesn't have a kind of what is essentially a really fierce spiritual hunger for something, you know, which is probably why a spiritual solution is so effective, because that's really what we're after, you know, and that you know, the quality of somehow creating a life that feeds that hunger is how you find out what a human being is all about.
So you think spirituality of some kind doesn't
I'm not crazy about the word, but I just know it has to go deeper than wanting, you know, the right lover, car, home, or job. You know, I've seen a lot of people who, when they don't get, you know, what they call cash and prizes, they go out and drink and drug again. You know, it's like, that's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point is being human.
Hmm.
And luckily there are a lot of people, a lot of really good people in recovery who can be your friends and who can give you a lot of support. And I think that's the most wonderful note of hope. You know, there really are people out there who can help you.
Mm-hmm. Any other words of advice for folks that are thinking of getting into recovery?
I would never want to be a poster boy for it. All I can say is that if there's a kind of nagging despair, you know, a nagging darkness in your gut and nothing else has kind of worked, you might want to see what it's like to go through a stretch of time not doing it and see if you can. And if you can't, you know, I would suggest checking into a 12-step meeting and sitting and listening and seeing if anything takes. Or you could, and you know, you can pick up vastly more than that and see if you relate to any of the stories.
That was This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching in conversation with Guy Kettlehack, whose books about GOBT recovery issues include Vastly More Than That, published by Hazelden. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. It's you, our listeners, who keep this program on the air. And you can get some queer history and top music and movie reviews on specially produced audio CDs as a bonus. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KAZU Pacific Grove, California, 2ECR Eden, New South Wales, WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.